stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. A spokesman for U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's team is responding to questions surrounding incoming National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's contacts with Moscow. Flynn reportedly had several telephone conversations with Russia's ambassador on the same day President Obama ousted 35 Russian diplomats and imposed sanctions in response to Russia's apparent attempts to influence last year's presidential election. Sean Spicer is Mr. Trump's spokesman.
The call centered around the logistics of setting up a call with the president of Russia and the president-elect after he was sworn in, and they exchanged logistical information on how to initiate and schedule that call. That was it, plain and simple.
Meantime, Mr. Trump told the Wall Street Journal he would keep the sanctions on Moscow, but might lift them if Russia helps Washington reach goals important to the U.S. U.S. officials are hailing the latest push by Iraqi forces into Mosul, confirming reports that Iraqi forces now have retaken a key government building from the Islamic State fighters. There have been questions about how the Trump administration would deal with the Islamic State. Syrian monitors say the Islamic State militants have launched an attack on a government-held area of the Syrian city of Deir az-Zor. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reports more than 30 people have already died in the fighting, including 20 Islamic State jihadists. Officials say the Syrian government used warplanes to beat back the militants. The Islamic State group controls most of Deir az-Zor province, but government forces have controlled the provincial capital. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Poland on Saturday formally welcomed a contingent of U.S. troops that arrived in the country earlier in the week, part of a NATO mission aimed at deterring Russian aggression in the region. Polish officials say the presence of American soldiers in Poland is another step in their strategy to ensure safety and security of the country. Eventually, the U.S. plans to station more than 3,000 soldiers in Poland, marking the largest troop buildup in the country since the Cold War ended. The deployment was ordered by the Obama administration in 2014 as a response to Russian aggression in Ukraine. UN aid agencies are appealing to authorities in Europe to assist and protect thousands of refugees and migrants trying to survive the harsh winter weather. They say people in Greece and the Balkan states are most at risk. Lisa Schlein has more.
Agencies such as the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and the UN Children's Fund say they are doing what they can to protect refugees and migrants stranded in Greece and the Balkans from the harsh winter. UNHCR spokeswoman Cecile Prie says too many people remain without help.
We are extremely concerned by reports that several refugees and migrants have lost their lives trying to enter or move across Europe.
UNICEF says children and their families are living in intolerable conditions on the Greek islands. The Children's Agency notes this is off-season. Since few tourists are arriving, it is appealing to Greek authorities to allow the refugees and migrants living out in the open to stay in the hotels, hostels, and homes that are essentially empty. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President Barack Obama used his final weekly address to thank the American people for helping to make him a better president and person. Mr. Obama also appealed to citizens to not take the U.S. democratic process for granted.
Our success depends on our participation, regardless of which way the pendulum of power swings. It falls on each of us to be guardians of our democracy, to embrace the joyous task we've been given to continually try to improve this great nation of ours. Because for all our outward differences, we all share the same proud title. Citizen.
Earlier this week, the president echoed a similar theme during his farewell address in his adopted hometown of Chicago. The U.S. Congress has approved the first step toward repealing President Obama's signature health care law. In the past few years, the House has voted more than 60 times to repeal the law, but Republicans had no hope President Obama would sign the legislation as long as he was in office. President-elect Trump campaigned on a pledge to overturn the so-called Obamacare. For more news, join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The key decisions that were made included the call for President Yahya Jammeh to facilitate and support the peaceful and orderly handing over of power.
The African Union says it will cease to recognize Yahya Jammeh as the Gambian president on January 19.
The doctors are not defiant. It's the court that is being misused by the government to make the doctors look defiant. As a fact, the court made decisions without ever listening to the doctors.
Striking Kenyan doctors say they will only return to work if the government implements an agreement signed in 2013.
This is a very good and important day in the humanitarian history, because for the first time, the humanitarian response plan is for 3 years.
And the Central African Republic's government launches a humanitarian response plan to help those affected by the country's conflict. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The African Union will cease to recognize Yahya Jammeh as of January 19, the date he is due to hand over power to President-elect Adama Barrow, winner of the December presidential election, says the AU's Peace and Security Council. To learn more regarding the African Union's decision on the Gambia, I reached Jacob Eno Eben, spokesperson for the chairperson of the African Union.
The African Union Peace and Security Council met yesterday. They had briefings from the chairperson of the African Union Commission, Her Excellency Susana Dlamini Zuma, the Commissioner for Political Affairs. They also received briefings from a representative from the Gambia, ECOWAS, particularly from Liberia, with the current chair of the ECOWAS Authority.
What were some of the decisions made by the Peace and Security Council of the African Union?
The key decisions that were made included the call for President Yahya Jammeh to facilitate and support the peaceful and orderly handing over of power to President-elect Adama Barrow on the 19th of January, that is next week, and that henceforth, beginning the 19th of January, they will recognize President-elect Adama Barrow as the legitimate president of the Gambia.
Obviously, the African Union supports the mediation efforts by ECOWAS to resolve this impasse in the Gambia. However, President Yahya Jammeh remains defiant and says that any effort in that regard basically infringes on the internal dynamics of the Gambia, which they said violates the African Union as well as the ECOWAS's working document not to interfere in the internal affairs of a country. How are you reconciling this to resolve this impasse?
The African Union definitely is in complete and total support of the initiative taken by the ECOWAS leadership in order to support the peaceful transition of power. The elections that took place on the 1st of December in the Gambia saw a victor. And on the 2nd of December, President Yahya Jammeh himself went ahead to congratulate the president-elect and congratulated the Gambians for the maturity of the democratic process. And all these, the elections happened within the framework of the institutional framework, the Constitution of the Gambia, the necessary instruments of ECOWAS, as well as the instruments of the African Union, particularly the African Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance. And so the instruments which the Gambia is signatory to. So the situation in the Gambia currently has gone beyond issues of sovereignty. It's in the interest of the regional economic community as well as the African Union to ensure that the will of the Gambian people is respected and protected, and that power is transferred from the incumbent to the president-elect come January 19, 2017.
President Yahya Jammeh remains defiant. He says nobody loves Gambia than he does. The head of the army has thrown his support behind him. People are worried and expressing concern that there could be possible violence if regional actors, and for that matter, continental actors, decide to put military pressure to remove him. How are stakeholders trying to convince him to leave power peacefully, despite his stance not to give off power, citing voter irregularities, which information he did not have before he made the first step of congratulating Adama Barrow? How do you reconcile all these?
President Yahya Jammeh's love for his country is what the ECOWAS authorities have been engaging in to ensure that there is a smooth and peaceful, not only transition of power, in the interest of the Gambian people, in the interest of protecting the democratic process, not just for the Gambians, but for Africans in general. The Gambians have spoken, and so the will of the people should be respected in that interest.
Jacob Eno Eben is the spokesperson for the chairperson of the African Union. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Striking Kenyan doctors have remained defiant despite their officials receiving a month suspended sentence from the Employment and Labor Relations Court. The Kenyan Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union maintaining its stance, the group says members will only return to work if the government implements a collective bargaining agreement signed in 2013. The Union Secretary General Dr. Uma Luga told me it is not true that his organization wants to make the government unpopular ahead of this year's elections.
The doctors are not defiant. It's the court that is being misused by the government to make the doctors look defiant. As a fact, the court made decisions without ever listening to the doctors, and you can never be convicted in any court of law in the world without being listened to. So that alone makes that judgment very defective. It's basically a heavy hand of the government to punish the doctors without ever listening to them. The suspension of the strike that was made on the 1st of December has been challenged by our legal team 3 times, but the judge refused to listen. The judgment itself to suspend the strike was defective because it was directing us to negotiate with a party that is neither an employer of doctors nor an association of employers of doctors. Secondly, the issues that the doctors presented in the CBA are too weighty and have been a cause of strikes, 43 strikes in the county governments. That are the small levels of government in the country.
Why wouldn't you engage with the government to resolve this collective bargaining agreement that was signed in 2013? Some people are saying that your collective bargaining agreement is excessively high. That will punch a huge hole in the country's budget.
The Kenyan budget in total is about 2.1 trillion Kenya shillings. 2.1 trillion Kenya shillings is about $210 billion US dollars. The country can afford. What the collective bargaining agreement cost the country is about 12 billion, according to the government, but according to the doctors, 8.1 billion. If you look at that as a total cost of the budget, so 8 billion over 2,100 billion is actually negligible. If you look at even the total health expenditure, which is 150 billion total in terms of public health expenditure, 8 billion out of 150 is also negligible. If you look at the amount of money Kenya wastes by paying for health care to Kenyans who go to India, it's about 10 billion. If you look at the amount of money that the Kenyan government wastes by paying private hospitals, which provides only 1% of care to Kenyans, it's 33 billion. So even if the government was to be right and say that 12 billion out of 33 billion that they pay from the National Insurance Fund, it's possible to get that money. So I think these excuses being given by government and the public is just simply a waste of time. Doctors will not go back to work until the government implements that CBA. And whether they bring a jail term, whatever they bring, whether it's 10 years, 20 years, whatever it is, they will implement that CBA.
Talking about the private health care, some Kenyans are saying that This is a total blackmail of the government, knowing that elections are around the corner and knowing that some of your members practice privately.
No. There's nothing like blackmail on the government. It's the government that is blackmailing doctors by not responding to their issues for 3.5 years. There's nothing about blackmail on the doctors. Apparently, doctors are very apolitical all over the world. And I think to even blackmail doctors by insinuating politics is simply to show the rotten minds of those people who are saying that. It's a rotten attitude that they are trying to bring into the medical profession. We are very clean professionals. The same way you trust the prescription of a doctor is the same way they should trust that when we tell them the CBA implementation will improve healthcare. That is exactly it. We are truthful, honest people with a lot of integrity who value our work and who love being doctors.
Barring a possible contempt of court, what is the next step forward to resolve this impasse?
You know, if the court wants itself to be misused, then that is up to the court. You know, the judicial system should be a place where people get justice. It shouldn't be a place where people feel like they do not get justice. There's nowhere in the world where someone can be convicted and be told that they are guilty without being heard. And that is what exactly the court did. And even yesterday, the judge called Dr. Sewage. Which country in the world, where is it that a worker can be called sewage and then they go back to work? It doesn't make sense.
Dr. Uma Oluga is the Secretary General of the Kenyan Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. The government of the Central African Republic and the humanitarian country team have launched the 2017 to 2019 humanitarian response plan on Friday. It has a budget of about $400 million aimed to meet the needs of over 2 million citizens who have been adversely affected by the conflict. To learn more about the plan, I read Josephine Ganji, the head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, in the Central African Republic.
This is a very good and important day in the humanitarian history because for the first time, the humanitarian response plan is for 3 years. That means that we are looking at a long-term vision while the humanitarian, what we call the financial part of it, will be done yearly. And this humanitarian response plan for this year, 2017, we are asking for $399.5 million. And I just want to inform you that one of the major objectives is life saving. And the reason we are concentrating on life saving is because the government has also launched in a parallel manner what we call the Recovery and Stabilization Plan, which will cater for the recovery part of it.
You talked about $399.5 million as your target, approximately saving or could save 2.2 million lives. How will this address any possible shortfall? Because promises are made usually, or pledges are made, and they are not fulfilled.
Yes, you're right. What we are doing is that this is a projection, it is an appeal. So this is what we'll be asking our donors to contribute and so that we can be able to save lives. What we are also saying is that the humanitarian needs in Central African Republic are increasing. Half of the population require humanitarian assistance, and that is 2.2 million people. You have also 1 million people who are displaced either internally or externally that require a humanitarian assistance. This country, 65% of the population depends on agricultural products. And because of the upsurge in conflict, none of these people have been able to cultivate their land, which means they will require humanitarian assistance for survival until after they are able to plant and harvest their crops in order to be autonomous. So the needs are increasing, and it is important that, you know, our donors contribute to this amount of money so that we can be able to save lives.
Some people have said that despite the amount of money the international community or the donor community has invested in Central African Republic, the problem keeps to be escalating. Why wouldn't they put the money somewhere where they can see visible or quick result of their money working effectively?
I think this is the reason why this time round, as much as we humanitarians are contributing or responding to the consequences of conflict, we are also going beyond our boundaries to work with other partners who are development and peace building. And the reason being that it is important that we look at, you know, sit all of us around a table and have a shared analysis of the situation. And then each and every one of us contributes to the bigger picture depending on their mandate. What we are asking for is, one, is prevention of the conflict. And if in the event there is something that has happened, we humanitarians will be able to respond. But there is also needs to follow up on the peace building. And that is why the government-led recovery and stabilization strategic plan, is going to handle this.
Joseph, as you know, the problem of this humanitarian crisis is as a result of the ongoing conflict. How is your office coordinating or cooperating with the government to help resolve this political and security crisis that has generated this humanitarian crisis in the Central African Republic to solve it once and for all?
Yes, the problem in Central African Republic is big, and not one entity can be able to solve this alone. It needs a holistic approach. And it is for this reason that we meet with the government, the UN mission in Central African Republic, the development actors, in order to look at the root causes of the conflict as we deal with the underlying vulnerability or consequences of this conflict.
Joseph Nganji is the head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, in the Central African Republic. He spoke with me from the capital, Bangui. U.S. President Barack Obama lifted some sanctions as part of a five-track engagement process. This is in response to what he says are positive actions by the Sudan government, including fighting terrorism. But one human rights observer says lifting sanctions forgives the Sudanese government for decades of war and human rights violations in Sudan and overlooks the continuing conflict in Darfur. For VOA, Ian Buer has more from Washington.
Leslie Lefko, Deputy Africa Director at the Human Rights Watch, says she is skeptical that lifting sanctions will have any positive impact on Sudanese civilians. She says the Sudanese government has a track record of not respecting the basic human rights of its people, and the move to ease sanctions is sending a message to Sudan and other repressive governments that abuses will be ignored.
To suggest that somehow this change of policy is going to suddenly encourage the kind of human rights reforms that are so desperately needed, I think, is naive at best.
In conjunction with President Obama's new executive order, expected to be announced today, the U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, is announcing an amendment to the Sudanese sanctions regulations. As a result, U.S. citizens will generally be able to transact with individuals and entities in Sudan. The sanctions were put in place in November of 1997 by then U.S. President Bill Clinton, who imposed a comprehensive trade embargo against Sudan and blocked assets of the Sudanese government. The sanctions were first implemented because the Sudan government did not end the civil war in then southern Sudan. Also in the 1990s, Sudan hosted terrorist leader Osama bin Laden as a guest of the government. The current sanctions restrict U.S. foreign aid, ban defense exports and sales, and impose various financial restrictions on U.S. citizens doing business with Sudan. The Obama administration says the Sudan government has made progress in ending military aerial bombardments in the Darfur region. But Lefko says HRW researchers have not seen any objective progress of many of the key benchmarks that would justify a change of U.S. policy. She says humanitarian conditions in many parts of Sudan is one of the worst in the world, and that the conflicts in both Darfur and South Kordofan continue.
We had a team in the Nuba Mountains just last month, you know, where the humanitarian situation is dire. There has still been no agreement by the government to permit humanitarian agencies into the Nuba Mountains, into areas of Blue Nile, where people are at incredible risk of food insecurity. They have, you know, very limited health facilities. There's virtually no education. And so, you know, this is, again, a concrete indicator. What is the progress that the Obama administration is referring to on these kinds of things?
Lefko says the Obama administration could have instead used its leverage to demand that the Sudanese government end abuses in the country.
They should have demanded that there be concrete progress on these benchmarks prior to lifting sanctions. This is just a gift to the Sudanese government, and I have no expectation that there will be the kinds of progress that we'd all like to see.
The U.S. Treasury Department says certain activities related to the Darfur sanctions may be allowed if they are licensed by OFAC and has issued guidance and statements on specific licensing policies. Sudan President Omar al-Bashir has for years faced charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court for crimes committed against civilians in Darfur. He has yet to be arrested. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
The daughter of Angola's longtime president recently took over a major bank and embarked on plans to restructure the state-owned oil company, moves that have raised eyebrows over the family's plans as her father prepares to step down later this year. From Johannesburg, Anita Powell takes a closer look at Isabel dos Santos and what the future holds for Angola's longest-serving first family.
As Angola's notoriously media-shy president prepares to step down after nearly four decades in power, all eyes in this southern African nation are looking not at José Eduardo dos Santos, but at his billionaire daughter. Though flush with oil, Angola is one of the most unequal societies in the world, a point that dos Santos's critics bring up often.
She's stealing from the state. It's plundering the state. And it does not improve the lot of Angolans. It basically impoverishes the country further, because this is money that should have been applied in other projects for the benefit of the country and not one person.
That's Rafael Marquez, a prominent journalist and anti-corruption campaigner who was one of Isabel dos Santos's fiercest critics. Marquez has sued her in a Portuguese court, alleging that she launched a public smear campaign against him over his reporting on her business empire. Dos Santos has accused her critics of playing politics and says she came by her immense wealth through hard work and professional competence. Forbes ranks her as Africa's richest woman. However, in late 2015, watchdog group Transparency International ranked her among the world's 15 most corrupt people and institutions. Alex Vines, Africa director at the London-based think tank Chatham House, says there is some merit to her argument. He says the state oil company, Sonangol, needs the reforms dos Santos is proposing in order to bring down costs.
And she sets a business lady for whatever you think about her having got the job, because possibly she is the president's daughter. There is an effectiveness in the reform process that you have to give her credit for.
Repeated calls to the media department of Sonangol for comment went unanswered. The oil company's website is flush with examples of how the company has reached out to the community with new roads, clinics, and housing developments. Other African leaders have appointed children and close relatives to top positions in government, raising speculation that they're being groomed to take over. This has been seen most recently in Uganda, where the president named his son, a 42-year-old two-star general, as a special presidential advisor. And in Equatorial Guinea, Africa's longest-serving president has made his choice of successor explicitly clear by naming one of his sons as vice president. But Vine says this future is not likely or even possible for Isabel dos Santos, who was born in the former Soviet Union to the president's Russian-born first wife.
Firstly, Isabel dos Santos is born outside of Angola. Constitutionally in Angola, you can only run for president if you're born in the country. Secondly, race politics plays a role in Angola. The MPLA has a history of drawing from black Angolans for its presidency. And that politics is still very much alive and well in Angola.
Instead, both Vines and Marquez agree, her industriousness is part of a plan to provide for her family in a post-presidential era. Another sign of this could be that President Dos Santos has also appointed one of his sons to chair the nation's sovereign wealth fund, worth an estimated $5 billion. If President Dos Santos does follow through on his pledge to step down this year, it appears the longtime first family will be well cared for. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
It's Free Town Forever.
From Freetown to Lagos, yeah. Let's get, yeah. I know go shoot by you,
no shoot.
I know go shoot shoot you,
no shoot shoot.
No believe to me,
no believe to.
Oh yeah, G job,
oh yeah, G job.
I know go shoot by you,
no shoot.
I know go shoot shoot you,
no shoot shoot.
Oh yeah, G job, I'm gonna no believe to me,
baby oh, baby, baby oh, baby.
I'm gonna shoot shoot.
Beats.
Shake body, lose body, forget your trouble, dance for me, make you no cry, jolly jolly. Waiting God say go be, surely go be, so why worry, baby no worry. Take a easy, suffer, suffer, life no wire bad. Na 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 na. This life, this life, eh.
Vanity.
When you yakba so tena.
Vanity.
When you tawa so tena.
Vanity.
Take the money you get na.
Vanity.
Why you they kill you company for vanity? Why you want gain the old one for vanity? You they kill you company slowly. You they stab a knife back before he face you smile to her. Yeah, bo. Dunia fool, so why worry? Baby, no worry. Take a easy, suffer, suffer. Life no way bad. Oh na 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 na. This life, this life, eh.
Vanity.
When you yakba so tena.
Vanity.
When you tawa so tena.
Vanity.
Take the money you get na.
Vanity.
Yeah, man. We totally property, we totally property, and not legally she. Who say you they care and we die? Always want for see me the cry. Yepo,
yepo.
Otalman na weda, Otalman quick for change. Papa God they see you. How you walk now so he they give you. So why worry? Baby no worry. Take a easy. Suffer, suffer. Life no way about.
Vanity.
Take the money you get now.
Vanity. Vanity.
Hey, 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 hey.
Vanity.
What's that motto, Kana?
Vanity.
Alta play song boy, Mr. Songs, Wayne with the business. Baby, I don't get another sponsor.
Bra bang bang bang,
Salman Quick. Nigerian breed, Asian breed. Everything I see, they make me ginger. She's beautiful, I know they die.
Sa 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 sa.
When he got to
abotombe abotombele abotombe.
My love for you, lady, to you. Yeah.
mal dil jeet hai ye phal bhuki hai mujhe receipt hai ye bol jam unke chhe gone peet hai bas I give the blessing I want to receive it if bad and I turn on many order for the children and got more so I get put them more than the police police nga galo kona kova then neg in my water no go leave you to suffer mwa sadun mu make I take you on a date I'm a me fan and love for the epic it for now let me know that got somewhere to quick
forget what you heard about me yeah, but my love for you only quite confirm. Yeah, I know you have heard a lot of things about me. Ooh, ooh. But my love for you only quite legit.
It's the eye.
It's my chance to fit there, yeah.
back am. Waiting I won't do, I'm on an emergency, oh, oh. If you leave me, baby, I know feel free, oh. I'm on a turn by turn, I might die be this, oh, yeah. I like a shoe, they show me love, Abby. You say make a sing song, Abby. Oh, no, Abby. Oh, no, Abby. And every time you come around, I like a shoe, they show me love, yeah. So we stand there and sing song, Abby. Oh, no, Abby. Oh, no, Abby. Oh, yeah, wait. Part one. I started feeling your body, your baby, walk one. Want to, I give it to you every day. I'm on my call too, yeah, yeah. Shawty wanna go down for me. Shawty wanna slow wine, no wine. They say she know I come for the money. She say she wanna be mine. Ziggy, baby, give me something. I want to feel it, oh, baby, give me. Ziggy, ziggy, you blow my mind. I swear you done blow my mind, oh, mine. Me and I feel let you go. One light a lie. Many things you need to know. Waiting I won't do, I'm on an emergency, oh, oh. If you leave me, baby, I know feel free too. I'm on a turn by turn, I'm a time be this, oh, yeah. I be your number one boy, Abby. I like a shoe, they show me love, Abby. You say make a sing song, Abby. Oh, no, Abby. Oh, no, Abby. And every time you come around, I like a show that show me love, yeah. So Mr. Love, sing a song, Abby. Oh no, Abby. Oh no, Abby. The Mr. Lover, man. Why all these ladies, they show me love? Say Mr. Love, sing a song, Abby. Oh no, Abby. Oh no, Abby. If I want to feel it, oh, baby, give me. Ziggy, ziggy. You blow my mind. I swear you, they blow my mind. Baby, baby, see as my heart, they feel my flow. Waiting I want to do, I'm on a number one boy, Abby. I like a shoe, they show me love, Abby. You say we can sing song, Abby. Oh no, Abby. Oh no, Abby. And every time you come around, I like a shoe, they show me love, yeah.
Nimekuwa kama samaki kutamani nisivyoweza. Kama nitanga niliapa nioe muweza. Na kama bahati wenzenu nilishapoteza. Squeeze ujanja ni kunywa mchuzi wa pweza. Aya maneno alinena wazee wa zamani. Ukiwa mjanja kuchapiwa ni siri ya ndani. Aya maneno alinena wazee wa zamani. Ukiwa mjanja kuchapiwa ni siri ya ndani. Masikini roho yangu mi. Roho yangu mi. Roho yangu mi niachie. Wewe ndo zako masikini. Roho yangu mi. Kisha tendwa ndo bye bye. Ya msondo mumpe ngurumo. Ayo mengine haya mfai. Mwana penzi limechacha nae. Wacha ni guse ni achane nae. Asini gande ni gombane nae. Hakuna mapenzi usibishane nae. Aya maneno alinena wazee wa zamani. Ukiwa mjanja kuchapiwa ni siri ya ndani. Aya maneno alinena wazee wa zamani. Ukiwa mjanja kuchapiwa ni siri ya ndani. Masikini roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi,
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, the death that will kill a man begins as an appetite. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a recent press conference, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry made clear that the United States has been more deeply engaged in more places to greater effect than at any time in American history. This is especially true of Africa. We have worked long and hard with country after country in Africa, with governments and civil society every single day, to combat hunger, to increase digital access, to train the leaders of tomorrow, said Secretary Kerry. One of the most enduring efforts of President Barack Obama may be the Young Leaders Initiatives, and particularly the Young African Leaders Initiative. In Nigeria, the United States took the lead in helping the country through a difficult election process and in the fight against the terrorist group Boko Haram. We've helped the Somalians fight back against Al-Shabaab. We have worked diligently to promote peace in South Sudan and worked with the region to try to bring people together and turn away from the potential of challenged and failing governments, said Secretary Kerry. The U.S. has helped push back against any number of violent extremist groups, including most recently supporting the Libyans in their fight against Daesh in Sirte, Libya. Together with its international partners, the United States led the fight to assist countries battling against Ebola, stopping the spread of the disease in its tracks. It wasn't easy, said Secretary Kerry, but President Obama made the daring choice of sending some 3,000 or so American troops there to build capacity so the United States could deliver health care along with the French and British. As a result, hundreds of thousands of people whom it was predicted would die by Christmas of 2 years ago were saved. And through the President's emergency plan for AIDS relief, the U.S. has brought the world to the threshold of the first AIDS-free generation in 30 years. In the years ahead, the U.S. will continue its mission in Africa and around the world of advocating on behalf of democratic values, human rights, including the freedom of the press, and contributing to the global goals of stability, prosperity, and peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.